Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is February 6, 2026, and this is episode 580. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York, where it is even more freezing, if you can imagine it. And you are listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And subscribe to the show. Support us. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in southern Italy. And John, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I mean, I've got my treadmill, and it's the most glorious part of my day to use the treadmill. I mean, I often have these old man regrets, like, I wish there'd been cheap Korean treadmills around when I was young and alive, but what I want to know about your winter is you've got a new puppy, right? How does the puppy react to having its first winter on Pluto?
So yeah, we're actually going to have, this has been, you know, the, as I said before, one of the coldest winters on record. This follows 5 years of warm winters, five of the warmest winters. And this one is insane. And we're now coming up to the coldest days, according to the forecast. It's going to be, with wind chill and everything, we've been told it's going to be up to minus 25 degrees here over the weekend. And that another winter storm is coming in the week after that. How does the dog do? So we have a puppy. She's, a mutt. A small dog, mostly a poodle with some Shih Tzu and whatever else. And she only knows, and we were talking about this, she really only became sentient, let's say, as we were into fall, and fall was very cold here, which was unusual too. And so she only knows the world as Pluto. And so she's not happy about it because, you know, you got to go out and do your evacuate, you know, do your pooping and peeping business. But she just thinks, well, it's kind of how the world is. You put a little like parka on her or vest or whatever that helps keep her a little bit warm. If it's not super cold, she likes to go on a longer walk. And when it's cold, I've tried to take her for a longer walk because puppies have so much energy. But she'll only go, you know, a few houses away if we can get her to poo or pee, and then she pulls to go back. So it's not much fun for her. You know, I think what's going to be pretty cool is when spring does come, when it gets above 32 and like really into like 50s and you'll start to see, you know, green grass and green leaves and all this stuff. I think it's going to be really exciting for her. It's going to be fun to watch that, and fun for my youngest son is the one who really begged for her and wanted her. And it's you know, his best friend and all that. And it's going to be, I think it'll be a lot of fun. She's a fun dog. She's a sweet dog. She's fun.
Oh, good.
But I think she takes out some of the lack of exercise frustration on the cats. And and one of the cats, Leuven, he's the bigger one. He's got some Norwegian Forest and Maine Coon. Leuven's got this funny way of dealing with the puppy. At first, he was kind of scared of her, and after a while, he decided, I ain't gonna show him scared no more. So his whole thing is just to lie down casually wherever she is. She comes up, she bites hard and doesn't know about really, you know, modulating her bites. And then we have the really skinny little girl rescue cat. And she actually really likes the puppy, but gets hurt by the puppy. But she loves, like when we have the puppy in the cage, Bella's her name, when we have her in her cage, which you have to do sometimes, she always tries to go and hang out with her. She'll sort of rub against the cage. She'll sometimes even jump over the high fence, which is, take some real skill just to get in there with her. But the puppy, you know, I've come around to thinking, seeing the little bush wars, as it were, between Leuven and Bella. And, you know, cats have all these weapons. I mean, they got the claws. They can jump really high. They have fangs. They, you know, they have all this little weaponry on them. But, and the dog is just jaws and jaw muscle.
Jaws and legs.
Yeah, and dogs. Legs. Yeah, you can. Yeah. She sits. She'll sit on him. And yeah. So yeah, they just it's muscle. They're sort of like they're like the Soviets or the Russians, you know, and the cat is more like, you know, nimble Ukraine with its high-tech warfare. And I got to say, the Soviets win. I mean, it's just, it's not really much of a contest here. The jaws and the muscle, and the back legs, it's not much of a contest, so.
No, but cats can usually avoid, you know, most novice rookie canids.
Yeah. And they do when they want to. But as I said, he got sort of, it's weird. It's like prideful. I haven't really, cats are not the most prideful animals as far as I
know.
No. But he's really prideful about it. It's like, I'm not going to be scared. And he swats the dog and claws the dog and sometimes hurts the dog. But he refuses to move when he's decided to lie down somewhere. So, you know.
An admirable
yes.
mascot for some defense force.
Yes. Speaking of warfare, we have a great pair of guests today. It's a great interview, a great episode, I think.
Yeah, it is.
I think you'll like it.
It's a great episode.
We'll be talking about the Angola wars with returning friends of the show, Brendan James and Noah Colwin from the Blowback Podcast. So let's get right to our interview with them. Okay, we are very excited to have with us previous Radio War Nerd guests and the co-hosts of the great Blowback podcast show, Noah Colwin and Brendan James, the co-hosts of the show. So first of all, Brendan and Noah, thanks for coming back on Radio War Nerd.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having us back.
Yeah, thank you.
So your new series... is the Angola Civil Wars or the Angola Wars. It's a great series. And I think, first of all, I really want to praise you guys just for the fact that you covered a story. It's a really big story, a big war or a series of wars, but it's sub-Saharan Africa. And it's not easy to find people interested in it in the English-speaking world. Mm. It's not easy to find, therefore, experts on it and so on. And it's been a source of frustration for us. Mm. And so you guys really got, you know, very deep into the weeds and the history, the players. And it's an amazing story or series of stories and wars. And so just wanted to give you guys praise for doing that before we get into this.
I agree completely. I just want to point out, though, as a bit of punk pedantry, that there was one moment in like the mid-1970s where the MPLA, I think it was only the MPLA that
yes.
they mentioned,
yeah,
got into popular lyric.
Yes. And it wasn't them or the UDA. Or the IRA. No.
It felt like a new type of challenge in our 6+ years of doing the show, just because there's always a lot to balance, and we always have to make decisions about how deep do you go and mm-hmm. how much time do you spend on the, you know, different dimensions of what, you know, often isn't actually one conflict, but galaxy of different things. And it was such a rich vein in trying to cover both the conflicts between Angola and South Africa, America's involvement, mm-hmm. the Soviets' involvement, the Cubans' involvement, but then within the Angolan anti-colonial, you know, resistance to Portugal that then became the three factions, and then conflicts within those factions. So mm-hmm. factions upon factions and you know, wars within wars. It was a little difficult at first for us to see how we were going to spin it all together. But I'd like to think that we kind of laid out as best we could the kind of, again, wheels within wheels that were going on with this with what we call the civil war in Angola.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And you know, I have to say, and we'll get to this when we, because I think we'll try and go somewhat chronological as you guys do, you know, talking about the war. But this was, even in my childhood, I remembered it, you know, brought back memories. This was kind of a pivotal moment in the post-Vietnam, or immediate post-Vietnam era. I mean, it revealed U.S. policy there, really revealed a lot about the country and where it was going. And it's been so buried and forgotten, unlike the other wars you guys covered. I mean, you recover a lot of lost history about the wars and the other episode and the other subjects, you know, Iraq and Korea and stuff. But this war has been lost, like completely, you know.
Yeah, and it's strange because at the time, as you indicate, there was a lot of interest. I mean, partly because in the predominantly right-wing American public, there seemed to be factions who, A, could fight, and B, were non-communist or anti-communist. And that had been kind of lacking in recent American history.
Yeah, one of the things that was most interesting for me in researching the season and then getting to write it was learning where Angola fit within kind of the American political rights cosmology. There is a very, because there's one moment in the mid-70s that is this, as sort of Mark is referring to, this immediate post-Vietnam moment where the American hand in Angola is revealed. And it's an opportunity, you know, it's sort of a very rare moment where Congress really cracks the whip after Vietnam and says, no, we're not starting another fucking war. Mm-hmm. And then in the 1980s, when America is no longer, you know, the political winds have changed and the Reagan White House is hardly feeling constricted, Savimbi support, which had continued throughout the, you know, the Carter years and so forth, Reagan just sort of says, no, 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 none of this is secret anymore. This isn't some quiet proxy war.
Right.
He is a freedom fighter, and we are going to, you know, like, we are going to make him the mascot or one of a several mascots for our global anti-communist struggle. And, you know, because of what people later learned about Jonas Savimbi and UNITA in Angola, that did not wind up working out.
And then you also, at the time, as I recall, because probably the only one here old enough to be to have been, well, let's say pre-senile during that era. There, you also, at least in the beginning, had to pay some attention to what was going on in Portugal proper, because Portugal proper had been, for me anyway, like the princess in the fairy tale who was just put into a half century of sleep along with the rest of the Iberian Peninsula. And then Portugal is revealed as the owner of vast colonies. I mean, I ended up working in a different one, East Timor. And the Portuguese were mostly gone from East Timor, but they were remembered in a bitter phrase that was very common in Timor, that they didn't dig one well in like hundreds of years of occupation.
Yeah, can you guys talk about the history of Portugal in Angola, how that starts?
The Portuguese Empire was an interesting one that we hadn't touched on before in the show. There's almost always some pre-existing empire that founds the, or rather serves as a backdrop to the events of any given season of our show. Mm. You know, the Japanese Empire with Korea, British in Afghanistan, et cetera. And so the Portuguese was an odd one in that it was quite a latecomer to the European, you know, matrix of competing empires. And it was pretty rickety and was also so late to the game that in its institutions and say things like slavery, it was being left behind and making look being made even more brutal and exploitative than most of the empires of the day. You know, the British Empire was going about abolishing the slave trade and slavery itself about 30 years before. Respectively, 30 years before the Portuguese even began to contemplate it. And so even among the other Western, you know, sort of powers and European colonial enterprises, Portugal was unseemly in its conduct. And Angola, as well as Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau, were its African holdings. It really didn't have a presence there. It had an outpost there, basically, from the 15th and 16th centuries onward. But it hardly controlled all of Angola. And it was the history of Angola and its surrounding African kingdoms, what were then, you know, distinct kingdoms, what's now the states we call Angola and the Congo and Namibia, that were fighting with each other and eventually allowed Portugal to gain a greater toehold. And by the 19th century, turn Angola to what we think of as like a modern, more modern colony. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Noah, you can sound off about diamonds and coffee and other things that the Portuguese were trying to get out of Angola itself up until the mid-70s when it all falls apart.
Yeah, Angola is sort of a funny place to administer as a colony because at once it has immense natural resources. The discovery of oil there becomes sort of the predominant theme of it becomes the most important specific resource for almost all of the 20th century there. But then you also have diamond mines in the north of the country that are especially valuable and in the 1990s take on a ton of significance. And you also, though, have Angola is one of these countries, you know, based on one's perspective, blessed or cursed by geography. If you are, the DRC, then called Zaire, or not then called Zaire, I guess it would be called Zaire later in the 20th century, but Belgian Congo, the DRC is, it has the most valuable mines and has consistently, no matter what the technological revolution is or what phase of industrial capitalism or globalization we're in, it produces minerals and exports minerals that are necessary to make the modern world work. If you want to export those, the Lobito Corridor going through Angola into the Atlantic Ocean is this valuable piece of real estate and is one of the reasons it's especially important for the U.S. and the Western Hemisphere because it's how this stuff gets to the West.
I'm sorry, but did you say the Lobito Corridor? is that really what it's called now?
Lobito, O-L-O-B-I-T-O.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, it goes from Katanga in the east of the DRC to the port of Lobito in Angola.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's, you know, Joe Biden's last trip as president was to Angola, essentially there. And this gets to, you know, the final big, you know, Brendan got to, I believe, referenced like the slave trade, which was Angola more than any other country in Africa is the origin point of people who became slaves in the West. It is a place that was depopulated quite substantially by slaving. And when Americans today, when Black Americans go to recover their roots there, it's, I believe, the industry for that. You know, West Africa is the other major origin point. But I believe that in Angola, the industry is the process of that is very, very well established at this point, a multi-generational tradition. And so there is a very, you know, in the case of the Portuguese, they were not particularly good administrators of empire, as I think has been established. They never invested in trying to, you know, their coffee crop was never, it was more quantity over quality with them. Coffee being another major export from Angola. And they were also essentially, you know, they limp really into the 20th century and into the Cold War era. And you really get the first stirrings of Angolan nationalism and rather truly violent Portuguese reprisal beginning in the 1960s, at least in the, right. You know, that's when the sort of drama of our story picks up and Angolan nationalism starts to get really explosive nationwide.
I went with my partner, Catherine, to the Museum of the Imperium or something like that in Lisbon, and the paintings were based, I think, on the national epic by Camões, which I've never been able to read, even in translation, because it's pretty damn dull. but it makes the allegory of the discovery and conquest of countries from Africa to the various enclaves in India and off China into a really Victorian porn fest. I swear to God, like there are gods and goddesses disporting in the surf of every landmass on earth in that, of every landmass on earth in that thing. And there are also, along with these very Rococo professional paintings, drawings and paintings of real service in the African territories, in particular, like Mozambique and Angola, by Portuguese soldiers who are untaught artists. And they mainly show the difficulty of getting around, like fording rivers on foot, going up into the dry, hot hills. I mean, it comes across as really grim.
Part of what the Portuguese were particularly infamous for, in addition to their brutality, was the difficulty they had in, as those works of art depict, administering all of this territory, which, by the way, made them really great neighbors to the north for Cecil Rhodes and the Dutch colonies in the south, and the Dutch republics of South Africa in the 19th century, because it meant that the Portuguese were never really a threat for expansion, but they could be relied upon to help keep the natives in check, which is a dynamic that recurs, rather strikingly, in the heart of our story, 100 years after that was the case in the late 19th century.
Right. So, Let's introduce, I think at this point in the 1960s, the at least two of, if not all three, of the sort of main Angolan independence fighting characters. There's Holden Roberto of the FNLA, Agostinho Neto of the MPLA, and Jonas Savimbi of UNITA. I don't know if Savimbi's already active at this point, I can't remember, but could you maybe talk about, I don't know, maybe Agostinho Neto at this point?
Yeah, Neto was definitely someone we thought, that we could provide a portrait of this season as one of the less, I think, lesser known, less iconic leaders of, this moment in post-colonial African liberation. Part of that is because he was never quite martyred, like, say, Lumumba, nor was he a particularly brutal or particularly outstanding leader as far as charisma and, how he was able to make his imprint outside of the country. But he was a very accomplished guy. He was a doctor. He was a poet. He had been arrested. I believe he was Amnesty's first listed prisoner of conscience, or whatever they called political prisoners that were being taken in by the Portuguese at the time. He'd been arrested, I believe, twice when he had gone back to Angola after his studies abroad as a young man. And his arrest by the Portuguese colonial authorities did spark protests. He was already, by the late 60s and then into the 70s, he was a very well-known and respected figure. Savimbi was even younger than him. He was a much more opportunistic guy, and he was sizing up the different. He belonged to the MPLA sort of circles.
Which were socialist or full-on Marxist-Leninist? Like, how would you describe it at that time?
The MPLA was socialist. Some declared Marxist-Leninist. I think it was a pretty big tent. Whereas Holden Roberto's group, which, went through many names, but, we can call it the FNLA because that's what it's now remembered by, its final acronym. Savimbi had been a part of the FNLA as well. And at the time that the Portuguese Empire crumbled and that independence, although in a very strained and tortured way, came to Angola because of the infighting that would happen, the MPLA basically had a base of support in Luanda and not very far outside of it. Whereas the FNLA, while it chiefly drew, I mean, it had a direct relationship with Mobutu in Zaire. And that was because Holden Roberto, I think, was his brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And it had a good base of support in the north of the country, of Angola. But it was increasingly seen as sort of a puppet, a corrupt puppet of Mobutu, and out of touch with the, you know, very eager revolutionary sort of younger crop of people who were trying to seize the moment with the decline of the Portuguese. The MPLA was becoming more appealing to people. And then I believe in the mid-60s, Noah, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but UNITA comes together as a group around Savimbi. And this was the sort of three factions, with the FNLA being the CIA's favorite faction. And for a long time, everyone assumed that they would be the ones to take over from the Portuguese once Angola was independent. But in fact, while elections were scheduled for the year after the handoff from Portugal, those elections never happened because there was already street fighting, battles between the FNLA and the MPLA primarily. And it meant that, you know, Angola's transition into independence unfortunately did not look a lot like some other more successful handovers that had happened years earlier on the rest of the continent.
Part of what made Angola's transition to sort of life after, like, post-colonial life difficult is that, you know, you would think in many respects you think, oh, maybe they're kind of lucky, right? Like Portugal in 74, Carnation Revolution, mm-hmm. a socialist officer's junta takes over. They immediately, the bulk of like Portuguese public expenditure is spent on supporting these colonies that have just swelled between the 50s and 70s. As difficulties in Portugal, it's economic difficulties in Portugal themselves multiply. And the system of administration that the Portuguese had adopted for Angola was one that really emphasized ethnic stratification. And so there are three dominant different ethnic categories that roughly correspond to the three factions of this period. And of those categories, Savimbi is the, you know, by representing the Ovimbundu of southern and central Angola, who cover such a huge geographic area, he is it's kind of a natural candidate for someone to adopt a rural-based guerrilla war against the MPLA of the left wing, you know, in the urban core. And the FNLA is, while it's the first successful national movement to sort of emerge in this period and wield conflict, I guess the thing that is kind of, and the one that attracts Western support the most, partly because of its ties to Zaire, as the transition goes forward, these, you know, this ethnic stratification, you know, that again, the Portuguese had relied upon and kind of reified, becomes, along with Cold War ideology, like the basis for a proxy war / civil war. Mm-hmm. That begins in the year leading up to Angolan independence in November 75.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's a scene in a novel that Mark first told me about and praised highly and quite rightly, Patriots by Sousa Jamba, in which it's the beginning of the war. All the factions are trying to sort themselves out. And, you know, the Bakongo are seen as almost Romulans or something. They're they're taller and more warlike than the local Angolan groups. And
mm-hmm. I think the narrator's from the Ovimbundu, right? If I remember
correct. Sousa Jamba was affiliated with UNITA.
He's a UNITA.
Right.
And the Bakongo are essentially ethnic refugees in the country, come from the country's deep interior and the Congo, who are displaced by conflict. And there's an enormous amount of ethnic and chauvinism against them in society.
Mm. Yeah. And he basically, the Bakongo emissary offers his local compatriot, you know, a jeep, a salary, and presumably CIA funded at the time, but they just didn't have the depth of ethnic or ideological loyalty, and they they fought their way south in the mid-70s, but then they fought their way back into Congo even faster.
I think that novel is probably one of the better... I mean, I read it in preparation for the season. It's one of the more well-known accounts, literary accounts of these wars in Angola. And this was a promising moment in that there was a socialist inflected Portuguese domestic revolution that let go of the empire and its holdings. But then unfortunately, as we mentioned, it became the beginning of a civil war between these forces, which, as we said, you know, the Americans were already puppeteering or fancied themselves puppeteering Roberto's group. The Soviets were a lot more cautious at this period. There's a great book by Natalia Telepneva that I think is called Cold War, Wars of Liberation or something to the effect. And she in that book, sort of catalogs a new emerging clique of foreign policy bureaucrats in the Soviet Union that are interested in being more solidly connected to the Neto, Augustinio Neto, not NATO. We had to make sure we pronounced everything extra carefully this season. Yeah. Forces inside of Angola. So the Soviets were conservative even when they began to support the MPLA. And they urged the MPLA over and over again. They urged them to do a lot of things because they didn't... I mean, the MPLA had some problems with its political practice, whether you were Soviet or not. But one of the things that they kept banging on to the MPLA from Moscow was try to make nice, try to make a peace deal, if not with the FNLA, at least with UNITA, which was, I mean, I don't know if they just didn't have good spies on the ground or good commissars, you know, taking a look at what was going on, but that was never going to happen. Although I suppose it's arguable that they could have had a better relationship in these early days. UNITA was going to be the Americans' favorite and the South Africans' favorite faction after the FNLA became untenable.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's also at least two books I remember about Angola by, I'm not sure about the pronunciation here either, Kapuscinski. In one of which he details waiting endlessly in a sort of J.G. Ballard frozen, doomed Luanda, waiting for the barbarians, basically. And everybody's packing up their stuff in crates. And into that void, the cowardice of the gerontocracy in the Soviet Union, come the Cubans. And this is one of their great moments. Like in his novel, they just show up, make the connections, drive people around, and have long coffee sessions with them, and just generally do a good job.
Yeah, the Soviets were very lucky. We see this in a lot of theaters. The Soviets were quite lucky to have the Cubans. The Cubans were a lot smarter and were willing to take risks where risks seemed worthwhile, and they paid off usually. And the Soviets, I mean, again, John, we've seen this over and over in so many Cold War theaters. At wherever you look, I mean, I'm thinking of even Oman and Yemen, but they're always preaching caution pretty much everywhere. They just kind of wanted to hold on to what they had. And
almost Christian endurance or something like, as my mother would say, offer it up.
Well, I think one of the two sort of not entirely, you know, like they're stereotypes, and so thus they're not always true, but there's a lot of truth to them, is that of the Soviets is not necessarily being so great at improvising, being strategically inflexible, you know, deciding on a strategy and committing to it. And the Cubans, I think, have at least, they more of a reputation as being very flexible, willing to try and respond to different things, or you know, abruptly changing tactics if that's what the situation demands. And, you know, it's an attitude that is, in the long run, over the course of, you know, almost two decades of involvement here, It makes it's why the Cubans are responsible for the ultimate success on the battlefield. But also, it's made to me at least all the more impressive over the fact that, you know, as the historian Pierre Glehesis puts it, is the only case in history like this of a poor nation for no, you know, not a neighboring country, not facing the same immediate strategic threat, of a poor nation intervening like this on behalf of another poor nation. Mm. And it's, you know, Fidel Castro calling a lot of these shots and being intimately involved with the battlefield decisions over the radio, over the phone from Havana, you know, in a pre-internet era and so on and so on, pre-GPS. Mm-hmm. It is a pretty monumental achievement.
That baffled
the battle against apartheid.
That baffled the South African defense minister, Magnus Malan. There's a pretty good BBC documentary called Cuba Angola Revolution, I believe the title is, in which they get interviews with most of the key players, including Castro. Hmm. And Milan is just like, I don't know how those chips did it. He was all the way over in Havana. You can tell that
bloody Fidel Castro.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, this was, of course, while an incredible help to the Angolans, because the Cubans come in essentially to save the Angolans' bacon in 1975, right as South Africa, which had long been eyeing to take over for Portugal as the I suppose they're a little small to be called an empire, but definitely the regional hegemon in southern
Africa. Israel. I mean, they're just
they
listening
are.
To it.
They really
they
are.
It's, Israel.
It is Israel to
it's
a
Israel.
T. And let me tell you, I even remember, and I went back and looked, that one of the things they used to say as well in their defense, now they didn't have the South African lobby like Israel does, right? That was one of their failings, I guess, and maybe and the black-white thing was a little too close to home. But I remember the South African apologists and promoters, they all said, it's an island of democracy in a sea of, you know, dictatorships and corrupt governments and so on. Mm-hmm. And yes, although, of course, the democracy hasn't really been extended to the blacks, but we've set up, they have their own little countries and they have their own leaders there and they don't really want democracy and they're not ready. Like, and then, of course, they're projecting power into all of their neighboring and then the neighboring to neighboring countries in order to secure themselves because they have to. It's so amazing how it
there
works.
There is a tweet that must be read at this moment by the great journalist Vincent Bevins.
Okay.
In April 2024, he observed, in the final years of South African apartheid, the white government decided it must 1) overthrow the government of Angola, 2) install a puppet regime in Namibia, 3) attack Zimbabwe, 4) attack Botswana, 5) attack Zambia in order to survive.
Yes.
This did not work. And it's you know, this was, I believe he said that like when Israel was in the middle of brutalizing either Lebanon or Iran or both at the same time. And I think, again, it's, you know, like it's not to say, again, history repeats in the exact same way. It doesn't. We all know that. Mm. But it is like the comparison, the historical comparison, the parallels are striking. They're goddamn striking.
They're very striking. We sort of, I'm sure listeners picked up on it. I don't always like saying it out loud. I like the show to speak for itself. But, you know, we're very self-consciously at moments trying to evoke what, at least in this these past few years, maybe, you know, as the show ages, it'll just, you know, feel like, another historical event that we're recounting, which is fair enough. But in real time, we were making this as Israel was bombing refugee camps, for example, in Gaza and claiming they were terror hubs. That is exactly, although I will note on a far smaller scale than Israel's been doing, that is exactly what, by a comparatively smaller scale, that is exactly what the South Africans were doing in Namibia. They bombed refugee camps, said, don't get mad at us. They were actually terror training camps, and they produced a bunch of phony, but to everyone who looked at them, phony-looking documents in the same way that Israel said, oh, no, see, you're all victims of Palestinian Pollywood propaganda. we can produce these Xeroxed copies of Hamas plans,
right.
You know, written in all caps saying, right. You know, all these horrible things that they were training people to do. These weren't refugees. These were terrorists. All the same stuff happening. And we should probably also point out, and we take moments in the show to point out, that Israel and South Africa had a relationship, actually. Yep. So the comparison is all the more apt. And, you know, essentially it came down to, I think that the key elements of it were there was tacit support of each other's systems and each other's ambitions in their neighborhood. South Africa, Israel would sometimes condemn the apartheid system publicly, but they would pass or rather abstain on votes that had to do with condemning Israel a lot of the time. South Africa would abstain for Israel. Israel would abstain for Africa. Israeli generals helped South Africa plan the offensive that the Cubans rescued everybody from in 1975. And then, of course, there was the cooperation over a possible South African nuke, which Israel was intimately involved in. And I believe our friend Cy Hirsch, who we saw the other night, was involved in reporting on at the time. So there was a functioning relationship.
Yeah, Mark was part of that. I mean, Mark was one of the beneficiaries, in an ironic sense, of the cooperation between Israeli and South African intelligence, right?
Yeah, the Anti-Defamation League was contracted, worked out a deal with South Africa's Foreign Intelligence Service to spy on Americans who were involved in anti-apartheid protests. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of Jews involved in that, right? Because Jews, liberal, and Jews, including myself, did not make the link then, right? Because, well, I wasn't a progressive at that time, but I was with a lot of Jewish progressives. And, you know, that blinder, I mean, it's not quite there anymore with younger people, but it is with over 40s. They just didn't see the link, but the Israelis knew they were right. That some point, they're all going to make the link between us and what we're doing in to Palestinians. So let's spy on them. I mean, they were not just spying; they were doing sabotage as well.
Yeah.
And it was really ugly.
And another Noah, you'll have to correct me if it's been a few months if I get any of these details wrong. But one of Carter's more, I would say, more sensible advisors. And diplomats, right? Andrew Young, am I right there, Noah?
Yeah, yes. No, the Andrew Young story, the UN, is pretty wild.
Yeah, the UN ambassador. Exactly. It is wild, I know.
He was you know, one of the more sensible voices on Angola oftentimes, and was taken out politically because of his associations with the PLO, which was just...
Well, yeah, it was because it was against Kissinger, and Israel struck they struck an agreement where... The U.S. said, we won't interface with the PLO. Like, we don't deal with them. You know, we deal with you. We're, you know, and that policy, that agreement of, like, non-recognition, non-engagement with the PLO was, like, a big reason why it was very difficult to exert any political pressure directly on the situation using conventional diplomatic means for a long time. And one of the ways in which the sort of Israel lobby, you know, got one of its first big dubs as such during this era,
right,
is they caught Andrew Young meeting with the PLO. Now, Andrew Young was the fucking ambassador to the UN.
Yeah.
And the Palestinians have UN, you know, representation. But the meetings were not public, and it became one of these scandals. I mean, if, you know, it was one of those, like, oh, Andrew Young's contacts with the PLO, like, led all the major networks, you know, the night that story broke or whatever. And Andrew Young, as Brendan was saying, one of the sensible voices on Angola, at least more sensible. You know, he was not a communist or anything by any stretch of the word, but he represented, you know, something like a sane view. And the Israel lobby happily, you know, dispatched him when they sent
destroyed him. Yeah.
He never had a meaningful DC job again after that.
Yeah, he was hated by the right mass of Carter's people. He almost symbolized, you know, Carter's willingness to sell out America and all his friends and anti-Americanism. Yes,
Brzezinski he's back, you know, in this season.
Yes.
And, you know, to keep us humming along, you know, past the mid into the late 70s and then into the, you know, 80s, it was very much like Afghanistan, mm-hmm. And Brzezinski's influence there with regard to Angola. You know, he thought that in the same way that America should be in that kind of proto-Reaganite way, you know, it should be extending itself, however progressive, you know, policy might be at home, it should be boring deeper and deeper into the third world where, you know, these battles were really juicy and that real tangible victories could be scored against the Soviets in Brzezinski's mind. And Andrew Young was on the opposite side of mm-hmm. that kind of, you know, State Department, National Security Advisor, inner conflict, the Vance, the Cyrus Vance guys and the Brzezinski guys. So, you know, you have Savimbi emerge and emerging at that point as the alternative, the heir to the FNLA, his group UNITA. And one of the more fascinating moments that we covered in the season was known as the Jamba Jamboree.
Oh, yeah.
In which... Oh, yeah. Really, quite concretely and openly, there was, you know, we think of blowback sort of as a catalog, if nothing else, of American Contras. Mm-hmm. You know, just the different teams, different orientations, different from different parts of the world, but all essentially, you know, these operations in which we use local fanatics, the most brutal of anyone on the battlefield, in order to score victories against. Perceived victories against the USSR, if nothing else. And at one point, the Reagan people just got them all together. And it was the actual Contras, the Mujahideen, other groups, and of course, Savimbi himself, who hosted it at Jamba.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, Jamba's was their like resistance city or camp yeah. or whatever it was in the southeastern part of the country. Yeah,
Jamba is an interesting. I interviewed a journalist. It's in one of the bonus episodes. This guy, or an ex-journalist turned academic named Justin Pierce, who spent a lot of time interviewing people who live there. And it's kind of a fascinating place because Angola, like as the 70s go into the 80s, becomes this very just like a. I mean, cliche words like war torn are kind of invented to describe places like Angola or Cambodia. During these periods where you have massive internal displacement of rural populations that are not particularly well accounted for. So like true numbers, particularly in the case of Angola, are hard to come by. Mm-hmm. And in Angola, there is also like a practices of forced kidnapping. And people end up at Jamba who are kidnapped from villages. And so young women or children who are made to, you know, essentially like keep house, do light agriculture and other things to sustain what is becomes, you know, yeah, this, I mean, like a African Contra city in the imagination more than the reality mm-hmm. of UNITA and its supporters. But it's this base, you know, straddling like the borders of three countries that becomes where Savimbi wages war for like 15 straight years and where like the press gets flown into by the CIA to, you know, hear him, you know, give lectures about how Angola's, you know, how UNITA is just one more fighting season, one more campaign away from, mm-hmm. you know, blowing those Ruskies out of the water.
All those campaigns by hurt the Russians at all costs mm-hmm. lobby from D.C. came to a bad end because the damage or the collateral damage, if you want, was far greater than anything that could be inflicted on Moscow. And in fact, Moscow was doing a good job of inflicting everything possible on itself. I remember there was a statement, even as Afghanistan was blowing up and the whole jihadi phenomenon worldwide was blowing up, by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was...
Well, he was the Carter, National Security Advisor, yeah.
Right, yeah. For the Carter presidency, which everyone remembered as a pacific and pleasant country. And it wasn't yep. quite. And he said, never mind all this jihadi stuff, which was pretty arresting at the time. If the price of destroying our enemy, Russia, in Afghanistan is a rebellion among a few Arabs, and that's how he phrased it, as I recall. It's a an easy cost. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, really? Okay.
Well, he more or less quoted himself later once 9/11 had happened and he was getting heat for remarks such as those. And he said, are you really asking me to compare, you know, defeating the Soviet Empire with some angry Muslims, you know, that we have to live with now?
Yeah, yeah, I think you know, he's like spun up Muslims or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So he never really, I guess to his credit, backed down on anything. He believed all that stuff. And we talked about that in our season about Afghanistan, the Afghan trap. He was speaking to a French journalist admitting that the United States policy was to provoke the USSR into occupying Afghanistan, which the USSR was quite loath to do. And they had all these reasons they weren't going to do it. And then they finally sort of reverse chickened out and for some reason went ahead with some pretty bad logic. But he said, yeah, we wanted them to do that. He later said he was misquoted. But then we spoke to some people who said that the who was at the – I can't remember which member of the government was at a funeral with him. But they said he said, no, I wasn't really misquoted. The Afghan trap was the real deal. Of course it was.
There's a lot of good documentation that suggests that was real, in spite of also, like, I mean, even more recent debate, Brzezinski historiography debates are trying to throw some dirt on that. It's just not true. It's real.
Yeah, and you look at the policy itself. It's you didn't have to write it down at the time for it to have been the operational, you know, principle. But all of this is, I mean, I didn't really realize as we were doing it, but seasons 4, 5, and 6 of Blowback are essentially happening. Big chunks of them are happening at the same time.
Yeah.
Because you have Afghanistan and detente collapsing. Mm-hmm. You have the Khmer Rouge taking over Cambodia and then marching into the 80s as insurgents that we're supporting. And then you have Angola where, I mean, the only guys who were missing from the Jamba Jamboree who arguably should have been there were the Khmer Rouge. You know, right. Because, I mean, maybe it was a little bit before they turned and were on our side. But not by much, probably a couple months. And that's the Reagan, you know, era is defined by our partnerships with all these guys, but especially Savimbi. And just to come back to him, you know, he spoke, I don't know how many languages. He was incredibly, he was incredibly charismatic.
Chaz Freeman said he's the smartest person he ever met in your bonus episode. I heard him say
despite the syphilis he believed he had.
Right.
Chaz Freeman mistakenly believes, and we want to be clear, it is mistaken. We put it in because we thought it was like entertaining, and it illustrates how a lot of people rationalize it. But there is no evidence that Jonas Savimbi was driven to madness by like syphilis. There's nothing that backs that up. He was just a bad dude.
Freeman was like, well, what did he say? He's like, I would always bring him books because just in case he was in a bad mood and wanted to strangle me.
Yeah. It was an insurance policy to keep from getting strangled by Savimbi.
Yeah. I went to politics and books. Prose.
Yeah, that's right. Good to politics. He also, I'm sorry, but he had another great line because he had worked for, he had worked under anyway, Paul Wolfowitz and Kissinger. And he spoke pretty well of Kissinger, which is too bad. But he just had such utter contempt for Paul Wolfowitz, he wouldn't even talk about him, except to say that he reminded him of Mr. Magoo, who would always he would always walk out of a building with a smile, saying, "Well, I just did a great job," as the building collapses behind him.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely Freeman was a great interview, and he's a classic Kissinger Realpolitik guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he likes the kind of, you know, chessboard, spheres of influence, you know, sort of brutal logic to the Kissinger stuff. But some of the biggest haters of the neocons are in that camp.
One of the other storylines that we cover in the season is that as the 70s go into the 80s, the policy that Reagan adopts in a diplomatic sense on the Southern Africa question, is called constructive engagement. It's led by Undersecretary for African Affairs named Chester Crocker. And Crocker is this kind of like rare, successful bureaucratic creature in that snake pit who is able to successfully say, like, no, we can continue to support South Africa without having to, like, you know, insanely vocalize and trumpet our support for like the worst people at every opportunity. We can act with a more subtle hand here. And I think that it is like part of where the context Freeman was in was that he, you know, was caught in this world where no, there's a bunch of people pursuing what was an effective, you know, again, like hard line, not like it was not yielding to the MPLA or the Soviet Union or the Cubans in any, you know, in any grand way. It was still a policy trying to outline and make support for apartheid South Africa and UNITA work. But it was just less categorically insane in the messaging and in the and how outre and how public it was than what the new right and what a lot of these other people who then became, you know, the neocons were advocating, which was, you know, essentially like, well, why can't we light the jungle on fire all the time?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I wanted to just add real quickly about Jamba before we get off it, because I vaguely remember it when I was younger, but then I read about it in one of Thomas Frank's books. He has a great description of it. It was considered at that time for the new right. I mean, it was put together by, well, Bill Casey and the CIA, but their point man was, I think, Jack Abramoff, who was the most notorious.
Jack Abramoff,
the most sort of notorious.
Jack Wheeler. It was
and
the
Jack
two of them.
Wheeler,
Jack,
the libertarian.
It was Jacks Wheeler and Abramoff.
Right, and right. Abramoff was like the head of the College of Republicans and a complete nutcase.
He's amazing. Yeah. He's like Hollywood high weightlifter.
Yes.
Pushing Hollywood High nerds down the stairs.
Yeah. Yeah, a very strange guy who went to jail, and when he got out in the Bush early Obama years, he tried to kind of do a David Frum and remake himself as like a centrist, liberal, friendly guy, and it kind of didn't. I think his heart wasn't in it, you know.
His hands were too dirty. He wasn't like a good little boy who just wrote speeches like Fromm.
Right,
he actually did crimes,
a lot of dark stuff. Yeah,
petty crimes. Yeah, he produced and banged the drum for this movie in the 80s called Red Scorpion, starring Dolph Lundgren, which was a kind of two for one. It was like a propaganda action movie in the Rambo mold, meant to indict the Soviet Union in a piece of popular culture over Afghanistan and Angola, which, you know, because it takes place in a kind of unspecific African country in which a Savimbi-like warlord, or freedom fighter rather, you know, is fighting for his country or whatever against the evil Soviets who were doing chemical doing WMD. They're doing chemical warfare, which the Soviets were accused of, but never actually having proven done in Afghanistan, certainly not Angola either. And Dolph Lundgren becomes a disillusioned Spetsnaz guy who ends up siding with the Savimbi character. And Abramoff used South African.
Yes.
I think they shot it in Namibia. And they use South African troops as extras and, you know, some production value. And it was produced by South Africans as well. The movie bombed and I think was like not even released in parts of the world where it was supposed to be released. But that was all part and parcel of his commitment to the Savimbi cause and the anti-communist cause in Hollywood.
I seem to remember that, you know, there's a famous quote that supposedly appeared at the end of Rambo 3, I think, that this movie is dedicated to the glorious freedom fighters of Afghanistan.
Well, you might have heard it in our show because one of the first things we debunked, sick of hearing that word, but we debunked in Blowback Season 4 was that is just some great Photoshop that someone did in the middle of like the 2000s.
Okay. And one it's of the great ones of all time.
Yes. As we said, it's spiritually true.
Yes.
But as Will Menaker, our buddy, said when we were talking to him about it, he was like, "You didn't need a title card at the end of that movie to tell people it was dedicated to the Mujahideen of Afghanistan."
Right.
Like that movie's very clear about what it wants you to take away. But it's just a screenshot that's never ever been found on any VHS home video copy of the film. no, because the joke is that it's supposed to have been switched, is that after 9/11, home video releases changed Mujahideen to the people of Afghanistan as an embarrassment sort of about 9/11. But it always said the gallant people of Afghanistan. It never switched them.
I always, I've tried to think through the process by which somebody's like, oh, fuck, they did 9/11. We got to change that thing in the movie.
Yeah.
Get them on the line. Get them on the horn stat. We got to fix that.
Buy up every copy from Blockbuster. We got to change
it. A little asterisk said that the ones who didn't take flying lessons in Florida.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, because I remember seeing that when I was like, it was like a sort of a Snopes.com thing in like, you know, 2006 or something. And I just remember in fifth grade or whatever, I was like, oh yeah, that probably happened. That's one of those crazy things you hear about. But when you kind of look at it all explained, you're like, wait, why would they do? How would they do this? No, Red Scorpion didn't have it either. But it was a very very potent, or at least it attempted to be a potent indictment of the Soviets doing these kind of their own Vietnams. And there is a line in Rambo 3 where Colonel Troutman, who's been kidnapped, says, "We had our Vietnam. Now we're going to give you yours."
Yeah.
Which was more or less the Brzezinski doctrine.
I was going to say that's what Brzezinski said to every war he could possibly get involved in. Last little bit of trivia on Jamba, and then I want to go back actually to the mid 70s, if that's all right.
Sure.
Grover Norquist is the one who wrote the Jamba Declaration at the end of it all. And I'm just quoting Tom Frank here, but he said it was a bit of high-flown folderol that aimed for solemnity but sounded more like the work of a fifth grader who's been forced to memorize the Gettysburg Address and the Declaration of Independence. But I want to get back to the mid-70s because this is the Angola War, the U.S. involvement, and the pushback against U.S. involvement. This is a very specific period that people have started to recover in all sorts of ways and think, you know, if only, what I kind of call it the American glasnost, like this very brief period of American glasnost from sort of 74. I mean, you could say maybe even slightly earlier, but let's say 74 through 78 when it's definitely over. Mm-hmm. And when the public finds out, is it from the public finding out that the CIA is getting involved in the Angola Civil War, that the Clark Amendment and all that sort of passed? I mean, could you describe what happens and the Clark Amendment and, you know, the effects of that?
Well, so essentially, we have in the mid-70s probably a unique period in the entire post-war era in American politics where you have Congress very actively asserting its role in administering foreign policy in a bunch of different places. The Vietnam War had truly like stained the reputation and the domestic political ability for the, you know, NATSEC blob foreign policy establishment to kind of get its way. And there were active operations, by the CIA, by elements of the U.S. military in all sorts of parts of the world throughout this time. And this period of congressional oversight and public scrutiny of this stuff should not be confused for an actual, you know, cessation in its activity. But there was, as the civil war in Angola began heating up, the CIA immediately, at the behest of the 40 Committee, the secret Kissinger body, I mean, that he directed an inter-service, inter-agency committee that he directed that sort of just set policy, they begin an Angola op because they see, oh shit, the Portuguese they're failing. The colony's going to go to shit. There's a Marxist movement that could take over. The last thing we want are Marxists in Africa. How do we get in there and so forth? And it ends up being way more of a fiasco than anybody bargains for. We know this pretty intimately because the guy who ran the operation, the guy who ran the Angola Task Force, John Stockwell, whistleblower.
Oh, yeah. He was a famous sort of defector from the CIA, right?
Yeah.
His book, In Search of Enemies, is It's really hard to overstate this. There is no other book like it that exists that was written without the agency's knowledge or permission and that details the inner workings of an operation from beginning to front. It's not by an outside journalist. It's by the guy who was in the middle of it. And he shows that the U.S. had no particular knowledge of Angola. You know, there's a he tells a story about how when William Colby had to go in to brief everybody about what was going on, he said, here's a map of Africa. This is Angola. Here are the good, you know, here's the MPLA. We're Marxists. We don't like them. Here's the FNLA. We know them. We like them. And here's UNITA. We don't know them so well. And it was Stockwell's job to synthesize a secret, you know, like American support for successful guerrilla movements and all this.
And the Clark Amendment, I believe it was like, I don't know if it was Clark himself, but it had been teased out of, correct me if I'm wrong, Noah, it had been teased out of some officials of the CIA that there was money going to Angola. And that itself caused some press, you know, focus on it.
Well, it's a big, what happens, right, is in November 75, the handover takes place and formally, and then there's this war that breaks out. The Cubans help repel the South Africans, the CIA-backed mercenaries fail. And all of a sudden, like, reports start coming out, and Cy Hirsch has a big one in the New York Times that said money was going to Angola, aid was going to Angola. And there are these ongoing congressional inquiries into CIA activity, and they basically trick a CIA official into admitting, oh, yeah, we're sending money there. We tell the full story
like
of it
boss,
in the show.
His boss was on the way for a hearing.
Like his boss was late, but he wasn't, and so they got him to admit it before his boss was there to tell him, don't say that.
They kind of squeezed him. Yeah, that's what I recall. And you had had a couple, I mean, you'd had the War Powers Resolution in 73. You'd had the Frank Church on the scene.
The Hughes-Ryan Amendment in 1974, it's still, I guess, kind of enforced, but all covert CIA activities had to be reported to congressional committees since then.
Right.
It's been like hollowed out.
And to be fair, elements of the Angola operation were reported to people in Congress. Like part of what's so frustrating with this stuff is always that, like, actually it turns out that like the heads of the Senate Intel Committee were apprised of what's going on. Yeah. They're essentially in on it. But the Clark Amendment is very similar to the Boland Amendment that comes later, a more famous amendment, one could say, in the 80s, which is what prohibited U.S. aid to the Nicaraguan Contras. Right. Similarly, aid was prohibited from going to Angola specifically. So it was an Angola-specific carve-out that lasted for about 10 years. So the U.S. was obligated to make its aid to Angola, to its aid to Savimbi and others, which it continued, of course, uninterrupted this whole period. It just made it secret.
Yeah, right. And this was, of course, also H.W. Bush. His run of the CIA was part of this. And much like we've discussed in other seasons, this was the moment of, and you've written, and I remember some of the earliest times I had read about any of this was from you, Mark. But, you know, Bush, after the promising moment of the Pike and Church committees, H.W. Bush oversaw the outsourcing, you know, of a lot of this. And we sort of bracket it in our show as one of these, you know, ways they did it was referred to as the Safari Club.
Yes.
Which is, you know, the just friendly French, Saudi, Chinese even. Communist Chinese, because we were getting closer to them, intelligence
Moroccan
services.
Right. Yeah, Morocco plays a big
Iranian,
part in the Angola story.
The Shah.
Yeah.
The Shah before the revolution. And, you know, the Safari Club turns up in Afghanistan most prominently, but also with Cambodia and also, you know, in spirit with this Angola stuff. So, yeah, it was it was just kind of that nascent moment of reorganization of the CIA. Formal pressure coming from Congress, but pressure that was obviously, as we've just been saying, not sustained or encoded into, you know, our DNA after that. It was a problem to be solved, not an actual consequence that had to be dealt with for the rest of its life, the CIA.
I mean, I would add that at this very moment, after the fall of Saigon, with the Church Committee hearings on, like the CIA and the military pulled very, especially CIA, polled in like probably single digits at that time. And the sense was at that time that the days of U.S. empire are done and militarism. And it seemed like there was a trend and that you could sort of, if you were on the right or the left, if you're on the right, it caused a lot of anger and grievance, which would come back. If you're on the left, it would seem like, well, actually, we're almost with the trend of history, like from civil rights to basically the empire's ending and the whole obsession with militarism and CIA and all this stuff was coming to an end. But it really wasn't. This was a very brief kind of high water mark for the Cold War liberal establishment. And it was kind of at its most liberal moment here before breaking hard. And I just want to point out here, Dick Clark, who was a senator from Iowa, he's the guy who wrote the Clark Amendment. He was ousted in the next election, 1978. Apparently, there's a talk that South Africa may have contributed $250,000 to his opponent. But the guy who beat him mocked him as the senator from South Africa, which is to say, Angola, you know, basically in a, not for the for the whites, but you know,
oh, because he's against Africa.
Hughes Ryan Amendment, which I mentioned, which was a very big deal that you know mandated the president to inform Congress of all the covert CIA activities. Hughes, the senator, he was ousted in. I guess he had to go out. He went out in 1975. He had a lot of skeletons in his closet. It's kind of a weird, interesting story. But so he was out by the next election. And Leo Ryan, of course, was murdered by Jim Jones's people. Church committee, so that's 75, 76. Frank Church at the time was thought to be probably the leading Democratic, you know, potential nominee for president in 1976. And it was already starting to become clear, I think, that no, it was considered probably too radical. And so his next, so he didn't go very far in the primaries, but he was also ousted in the next election that he faced in 1980 by pro-South Africa Republican libertarian Steve Sims. But Sims was encouraged to run by James Jesus Angleton. And then Otis Pike, who I wrote about, who had been a congressman from a Long Island district since forever, and then he took over the Pike Committee, which was embarrassing, which was even more embarrassing to the CIA. He was ousted in the next election in 1978. And, you know, a lot of things changed. Like, Andrew Young is out. Cyrus Vance is almost out. You know, he's on his way out. And Brzezinski is very much in. But if it's like, if you're going to get Brzezinski, why not get the real thing with Reagan?
Yeah,
you know, so things are just really turning in a big way at this moment. So, you know, getting back to when Reagan comes to power. I mean, first of all, as you, I had forgotten this. In 76, he had held out the possibility of helping the white Rhodesians. I mean, this, you know, the bits of Reagan that you have in there are just such a reminder of how, I grant you, Trump is definitely putting it to the next level. But how he is, Trump is in a line of right-wing, you know, politicians.
Oh, yeah.
That starts with Reagan in a big way.
The reason he was so beloved on the right and comes from the far right initially is that very reputation that no one now discusses, which is that he hated civil rights. He hated, you know, any kind of freedom
young
of expression.
People. He hated college students.
Yeah,
that
he called
loved
them all
him for.
Bums and... Yeah. You know, he was.
Well, they made
re-watching
his career. The University of California system was his best co-star.
I've been rewatching Mad Men, and there's a in the later seasons they go in to pitch some like uber conservative cereal company or something, and the conversation turns political. And the guy is so right-wing, they think he's talking about supporting Nixon. He's like, Nixon will sell us all out. Dutch Reagan is a patriot.
Yes.
And, you know, going from Dutch Reagan to kind of, you know, St. Ronald Reagan, where he just, I don't know, whatever people's, you know, think of him now on both sides of the aisle. He brought people together and he was the kind of twinkly-eyed granddad, you know, that that image came way later. He was known in his time by his fans, especially as a uncompromising right winger. So Savimbi was perfect for him. Savimbi was able to be to pose himself and to allow himself to be beatified as this Christian, which he was, came from a Christian family, this Christian warrior in, you know, these people's minds, darkest Africa, you know, fighting for values that that the United States wanted to hear a lot more about during those Reagan years all of a sudden. And if, you know, he got the stingers just like the Mujahideen did.
I know. That was wild.
He got to go to the White House all the time. I mean, he was a true celebrity freedom fighter in a way that the Mujahideen never had a guy, you know. I mean, maybe some of them were popular. So some of them became popular later on TV, but during the actual period of direct collaboration, the Mujahideen or the Contras, they never had a guy like Savimbi who could be so telegenic and so, yes, so much a messenger of specifically Christian anti-communism, that the Reagan people were able to point to and say, this is our guy.
He really was charismatic in a big way, in a way that, you know, this is one of possibly the failings of or shortcomings, let's say, of the MPLA. I mean, they didn't have a leader with that kind of charisma. And even worse, after Agostinho Neto died, you know, an untimely early death, they got Dos Santos.
Yeah, you get the stuffed shirt with Dos Santos, and he oversees sort of the defanging of any real socialist character, embattled though it was, of the MPLA. And by the end of the 80s and the early 90s, when the first phase of the war, I mean, talk about a phase, it was several decades, but the first sort of go around is winding down. There are elections and a UN peacekeeping operation that are proposed in the early 90s for Angola. Again,
essentially the most brutal, deadly, and violent phases of this war happen after the Cold War, essentially.
Right.
The body counts get more intense. Savimbi gets way more desperate. And he has diamond smuggling money, and
he loses more, the elections in early the early 90s, to be
but
clear.
But then he
said they were faked, right?
And moreover, he was also like, he didn't want to, there were plenty of opportunities that he could have had for a power sharing agreement.
Right.
If you look in Angolan civil society today, huge numbers of people are formerly in UNITA. UNITA is not Ireland. Which is not to say there is no ethnic tension and this stuff doesn't abide, but that there was absolutely the capacity for reconciliation at a lot of different levels in society. It just so happened though that would have been very inconvenient for apartheid South Africa, which, you know, the U.S. is supporting, and the U.S. blessing is obviously, like, it's, you know, as the highest deity, so to speak, like, the U.S. blessing means that you get to have the war, but it was the South African support throughout these years that essentially kept it going, you know, like they were the people who actually had Savimbi bought and paid for. If you were a journalist and you went to Jamba and you had a soda, it's, you know, the label was South African. Your cutlery came from South Africa and so forth.
Right.
The linens on your bed, whatever. Where it gets, I think, in the late 80s, difficult for Savimbi to sustain the pretense of the war as he did earlier on when he was more of an objective new right darling, is around 89. And it's because in the Western press, he gets revealed as, like, he had overseen witch burnings. Mm-hmm. He was personally violent to women. He killed
a lot of his lieutenants for perceived disloyalty.
The most famous one being his representative, his aunt. Like, here's a bit of advice. If you run a movement that in large part depends on goodwill from the Western press and foreign governments, don't purge your own envoy to them. You know,
yep.
Tito, yeah. like and he didn't kill him at first. Like, it was, you know, he got him in prison. It made him a cause celeb. So there's stories in Channel 4 and the New York Times. And it just, like, by people turn on him who had been his defenders in the Western press. However, Brendan, you could take it there.
Well, I was about to say he did kill other lieutenants of his, which is part of what that that guy was trying to bring to people's attention. And it was beyond mafia style, where the wives were killed and children were killed. And
he burned was, in some cases.
And he was truly a cult-like figure.
Yeah.
UNITA was a cult as a political organization. But then, and so as we said, you know, he fails to win the nation's heart for some strange reason when the elections come around. While he got a chunk, but you know he didn't win.
Yeah. He ate it. Tried eating it is the problem.
And so then the war, you know, kicks off again. And as Noah said, it wasn't strictly the main coverage of our season. By this point, the Cubans are gone. Mm-hmm. The Cubans' mission had essentially been, as they had to remind their own hosts sometimes, because they were really, you know, such an effective fighting force that mm-hmm. the Angolans would often, you know, try to have them stand in for a proper army of Angola. But the Cubans' goal was to protect them from external threat, invasion from South Africa. It's why they got there in 75. It's why they stayed there and eventually drove the South Africans to militarily a stalemate, but effectively a defeat at Quetzalcoatl in the late 80s.
That's when they introduced the MiGs, and the South Africans were like, they can't. It was such an Israel, not yet happened to Israel moment that you know, someday might. Like, wait a minute, they have an Air Force. Only we get an Air Force. And it
There's a Chester Crocker interview on that campaign in which he's very sore loser about it all.
Yes.
And he says, oh, that wasn't a victory. That was a stalemate.
Yeah, but the Cubans they packed up and left. You know, they said we've defended you. South Africa is not going to invade you anymore. They were never so keen on being a part of the war against the insurgency. Even though Savimbi was, of course, directly connected to the South Africans, that was handled, or as often as it could, that was handled by the Angolan army itself. And so once the Cubans leave, the South African issue is solved, but the internal civil war is not solved. And so, as you both mentioned, Savimbi dies in the early 2000s, and only then does the Angolan civil war really come to a close. A horrifying body count, hundreds of thousands. It's always difficult to really establish a body count, but it's in that ballpark. Right. Much like Cambodia, mines were a huge problem. After the war, and cleanup of mines. And Dos Santos, by that point, had become, you know, just your standard idea of a corrupt and ruthless and rather unpopular dictator. Mm-hmm. And so there was, you know, still the MPLA, but it was hardly anything resembling the liberation movement or political party associated with that movement from the 60s and 70s. And he was a very, we're told he died not terribly wealthy.
Yeah, that
but
was
that, didn't his daughter like flee the country?
Oh, yeah.
Like the richest woman in Africa.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like he died, the thing with Dos Santos, somebody that we interviewed, sort of like an Angolan academic we interviewed, kind of impressed upon us, is that like one, you know, corrupt, extremely flawed to say the very least, but he did cede power and there was a peaceful transition and the people who run Angola now are not in his family. And, you know, there's incredible corruption. It is a classic Petro state, you know, situation, and so on and so on. But, you know, that counts for something. However, his daughter, Isabel Dos Santos, she's not just picked on by Western authorities for corruption. You know, she's not just like a scapegoat. Like, she really is. Like, the Angolan government, has a lot of charges against her. It really does seem like she went above and beyond what it means to like take resources out of the state. So there is and remains a legacy in Angola. I mean, it's, you know, there are articles you can find now about like, why is this random African capital? I don't mean random. I'm describing how these articles describe it. But like, why is this random African capital the most expensive place to live in the world? And it's because like, you know, this is an incredibly unevenly developed country.
Right.
And, you know, now, because the mines have been dealt with a lot more substantially, because there isn't the civil war, the year we made, you know, we began working on the show and releasing it last year in 2025. At the beginning of that year, the New York Times published like their top 50 tourism destinations for 2025. And number two was Angola, you know, on the grounds of like safaris and luxury tourism. And while I don't think that Angola is, you know, again, it's not, it's not a success story for the socialist model, and it's not a success story for like, you know, national development with oil revenues. It is like when you look back at what was at stake in the 80s and 70s, which is to say, you know, when the apartheid governments were fighting there, it is actually not that difficult for me to imagine a much a version of it that is much, much worse, where the violence was never resolved, where rule of law is like has way less impact, and which is unable to, at least even in some capacity, like organize for some of the natural resource wealth that comes out of Africa to be directed for the people, even if it's not there yet, and even if it's, you know, dramatically imperfect, again, to be a little bit understated about it.
And we've just come back from Cuba. And the Cuban dimension of the sort of story of Angola in this period is really important. And I don't think it, you know, delegitimizes or cheapens the immense and immensely successful struggle that the Cubans teaming up with the Angolans and sometimes now it's overcorrected, also the Soviets. You know, we kind of rode with the tagline for this season about, you know, against the Soviets' wishes, you know, the Cubans went in. And that's true. The Cubans didn't inform the Soviets. But the Soviets did play an irreplaceable role in making sure that South Africa did not topple Angola, and to a degree, therefore, Namibia eventually as well. And I don't think, honestly, at this point, that Angola celebrates this chapter of history and of collaboration with Cuba in the way that you would expect. The Cubans are very, very proud of it and remain proud of it. I mean, and so for, when I say the Cubans, I mean, you know, Cuba as a nation has memorials and, you know, this kind of very, very public concept of what was done. And the Cubans came to the aid of Ethiopia as well in the same period. I wouldn't call the dirge a smashing success either. But this was not known at the time. You know, at the time, it was another, you know, ruthless, but ultimately, you know, embattled Marxist movement that was being invaded by somebody else. And the Cubans said, we're here to help, just like Angola. And so I think you could argue things turned out equally bad, if not even worse, in Ethiopia for you know, all things considered. But it doesn't mean that the Cubans' mission there is any less striking or commendable, honestly.
I got to say, Cuba's a great friend to have.
Like, Cuba deserves, like, it wasn't also, they weren't just sending over soldiers and everything, obviously. Like, when the Portuguese population, like, one of the most viciously racist white settler colonial populations that, you know, that there was, you know, in all of Africa, by all accounts. I mean, they threw their car keys into elevator shafts, which they then poured cement into before they left. You know, there's a lot of news coverage in the West from the time of all the Portuguese settlers leaving, you know, a lot of like real boo-hoo stories about what they were giving up. There were, you know, these were people who hadn't put any resources at all into the development of the actual native Black Angolan population. And as a consequence, I mean, Fidel, you know, when he was explaining and justifying Cuba going to such great expense when times were not so easy in Cuba itself to support Angola, saying like, look, like this is a country, you know, however many times bigger than our own. And they got two doctors. They got nobody. Right. You know, they don't. There's nothing resembling like people who can operate the industrialized infrastructure they do have. Right. It was astonishing. The extent to which like Cuban support, you know, be above and beyond the military was essential in just like helping Angola survive the transition into being a non-colony.
John, didn't you get treated when you did your first fall in September in Calabria? Weren't there some Cuban doctors? I mean, that's the poorest part of Italy.
Very many there. I was very surprised at how common Cuban doctors were. In fact, I had this one scary moment, scary in a funny, we're all joking here way, when they were taking me into the operating theater and one of them said, oh, you're American, huh? Yeah. Yes, I am. And,
Canadian?
She said then, oh, well, I'm Cuban, so I'm not so fond of Americans. Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. What you have to understand, John, is that, that doctor is actually enslaved by the Cuban government and doesn't secretly loves America. Yeah. And that's probably why everything turned out okay, is because
she was probably just giving me Morse code hand signals all over the place. But yes. I was a little preoccupied at the time.
Yeah. Well, that's how they get you, you know.
Well, guys, this has been a great talk. And I want to say there's a lot in your series that we did not discuss. In particular, I mean, we've alluded to them, but there's a lot of war in there. And it's pretty amazing warfare. And it goes back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of some of the major battles culminate in sort of 87, 88. In fact, one of them was the largest African armored battle, I think, since World War II. Isn't that right?
I believe so.
Guido Cuonavale.
Right.
It's a special, like, to me at least, part of what makes it such a strange and, you know, like a subject that I hadn't appreciated the nuances of is something we said at the top of the show. So much stuff converges with it. You know, if your interest is in it as like as this kind of conflict, and then also as a decolonial story or as a Cold War story or as a nationalism story, or as an end of apartheid story and all of the above.
And American politics, too.
And American politics for a time, intrude, you know, that has a habit of intruding. Yeah. It's a very, it's as rich a story as any as we've told on our show, among the richest even.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on.
Thank you.
We are going to post links to Blowback. It's a great series. Definitely get it. Thank you again to Brendan James and Noah Colwin for being on Radio Warner. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye.